Welcome to the Fitness FAQs podcast, where we learn from the smartest people in the world. I'm your host, Daniel Vadnell, a physio from Australia with more than 15 years of calisthenics experience. Bill Maeda is a 54-year-old personal trainer and married dad from Hawaii. His unconventional training methods address what's missing in mainstream fitness. Bill Maeda's shredded physique and movement mastery are a testament to his wisdom we're about to absorb. Bill, did you always train unconventionally, or did you start training conventionally when you began?
I think Bruce Lee is really underappreciated in his role, the role that he played in the fitness culture of at least this America, because almost every guy that I ever kind of like idolized or the other guys that I see, we all have something. Bruce Lee had something to do with every single one of us. I started actually kind of lifting weights. When I was 10, I was just doing push-ups and sit-ups, and I literally had my parents find me a length of chain. They wouldn't buy me nunchaku for probably good reasons, but the chain, I would do all that stuff that he was doing with this length of chain. And so that was kind of my first foray into working out. I didn't even consider it training. I was just trying to be like Bruce Lee. But I got my first dumbbell set. And back in those days, the dumbbell set I got were these plastic things that were literally filled with poured concrete. So if you put them down hard enough times, a lot of old farts like me would remember these weights. They also sold these round weight plates. It's made the same way. It was literally like if you took a food container and filled it with concrete, and then you expect that to last. That's what all the weights were made of back then, if you were just getting started. So, and I was just doing curls and overhead presses and push-ups. I didn't know anything about squats, and I did sit-ups back then. As I got into my teenage years, I just did what everyone else did. So I got really serious into weightlifting and training. Probably at age 15 is when I started. And I was just doing curls, bench press. This sounds crazy. I didn't really start squatting until high school. So for about age, I mean, like late in high school, like my senior year. But I did all the conventional movements. I love the barbell squat. To this day, that has always been more of a foundational lift for me than the deadlift. I found that the demands of the barbell squat placed on me were just having that weight much higher on my body lever, and also not being able to bail. I mean, I had to be much more careful with that lift, and I felt systemically it was a slightly more for me intelligent lift. Like deadlifting, I could, sometimes would smoke a little weed and hit the weight room. And, on those days, I could I could deadlift just no problem. But on squat days, I had to be kind of on it. And it was all conventional deadlift, squat, cleans. I never really was a big fan of the bench press. I did it, with my brother and friends, but overhead pressing made more sense to me. I didn't do a lot of bench pressing because even back then, everything I did was based around martial arts. At the time, it was mostly karate and more striking arts. And then as I got up into high school and started wrestling a little, but to me, all of my weightlifting, that's one thing, I guess, no matter what I do, whether it's a conventional lift or some of these weird things that you might see me do, if it doesn't in some way simulate the conditions of combat and or make me better, then I don't really have much of a interest in it. That's why just heavy deadlifts and even now heavy squats, I don't really do that much of it because I'd rather invest that time and energy in the and resources into things. Like, to me, it's more important that I can do a decent pistol squat with just my body weight. I find that a much more applicable lift to real life than having a heavy 1RM single on a squat or a deadlift.
That makes so much sense, because with martial arts, you're moving in these very fluid, free, and unconventional ways. It's not predictable. So it makes sense that your training had to be able to accommodate and strengthen these strange movement patterns. But I like that you still stuck true to some of the key compound lifts, because we know they're such good bang for your buck exercises. They offer so much. They can be progressed consistently. But it just drives home the fact that function in fitness is super key. What might seem strange to the average gym goer with you doing these asymmetrical lifts, one leg pistol squats, is normal for you because you came from a martial arts background where moving in strange ways was conventional.
Because most fighting occurs either on your feet or on a mat. Anything that like required what I call furniture, I avoided. So bench pressing, I really have never been a fan of machines. If I do things like cable rows, I will tend to always do them standing up or in a water ski position. I don't like to sit down and do rows. I despise devices that you put your chest on a pad and it provides the structural integrity for a row. I've never understood that. I mean, no dig on people that do that or like that exercise, but to me, for my purposes, that never made any sense to me.
It makes sense because you have to create your own stability instead of relying on external stability from a machine.
Yeah, you know, like if I'm pulling someone towards me, I got their gi, it would be nice if something would hold my chest as I pull them. That would really help me out, but the reality of things is not so. So anything that required me to sit or lie down, unless it was on the floor, like I'll do a floor press with a sandbag, which is kind of one of the hardest presses I can do, because that simulates having somebody on top of me on the mount or whatever, and I don't have the luxury of the stretch reflex by my arms going below the floor and being able to stretch, and then I'm dead right here and I somehow have to generate that force. And so a sandbag floor press has a lot of utility to me, much more so than a heavier bench press. So at the same time, for those, if you're younger or whatever, and you like to bench press, nothing develops the chest musculature and just the upper body. There are a few exercises that I know that do that better than the bench press. So if that is your goal, have at it. That is the king of upper body, at least the anterior, the front of the body. Bench presses, yeah, it's not a bad exercise. It's just something that for my purposes, especially at my age, you know, I'm just not going to the beach and meeting girls anymore.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
But anyway, yeah. I don't want people to think that that the bench press is bad. It is not.
With calisthenics movements, what are the biggest lessons that you've learned over the years from bodyweight training?
I didn't know how to answer that question when I was much younger, because God, the first time I tried anything outside of a push-up, I quickly didn't like it. Because, you know, I was bench pressing, I was doing all this overhead pressing, yet I couldn't understand why just doing a handstand against a wall. In fact, I just most recently, I don't know, a day or two ago, posted how bad I still am at just trying to get a handstand against the wall. I was, you know, I did that just to, couple nights ago, and I haven't done that in literally over a year. And I'll discuss with you later on why. It has something to do with my diet and other issues that I had going on. But what calisthenics did is it showed the gaping holes in my kinetic chains that I had developed with conventional weights. So, these weren't small gaps. They were chasms. And I learned that anything that was outside the groove of what I was doing with traditional weights. So anything that was off to the side or front to back or one legged or everything would just fall apart. The linkage in my system was, and at first when I was younger and, you know, like all, a lot of young people, we tend to be naturally driven by more by ego than anything else. I simply, my fix for that was just to not do a lot of calisthenics. But later on, when I kind of started, before when I was really young, I didn't really care about, it's weird, I didn't care about bodybuilding. But for some reason, the way that calisthenics guys, especially on the, everyone knows those guys on the Olympic rings, the way they were built was much more the way I wanted to look and function than these huge, these bodybuilders that were on stage. Yeah, that was, a lot of it had to do with just the way these gymnasts looked. But to see the things that they were doing, as I got better at weightlifting, I was getting stronger and I could do heavier weights, more reps, and I was getting bigger. But there's a part of me that every time I saw those guys doing whatever, their pull-ups or their rings works or their dips, you know, if you're starting to feel like you're good at something, but then you see some people do things that you know you can't do, that's when it starts to bother you. Before, to me in the past, it was just like, well, I'm new to this weightlifting thing too, and I suck at gym, at calisthenics, so I'll do the one that I'm better at. But once I started getting like the guys in my high school classes, I started really getting a lot of respect because I look, you know, the movie The Terminator came out back then and everyone was calling me The Terminator because I was like the biggest guy in the school, which wasn't saying much in Hawaii. There were mostly Asian guys in school, so there weren't a lot of huge guys. So I was considered big. But anyway, but later on when I would watch these calisthenics guys and just guys in the gym that could do stuff, not on the Olympics, and I knew I couldn't do what they could do. And they looked really good in some ways, better than me or the guys that only the tons of other guys that only did weights. That bothered me. But I didn't really get into my calisthenics until COVID, until Hawaii went on lockdown in 2020. That's where most of what I'm doing now came from. And most of that came from you. I mean, yeah, I've been watching your fitness FAQs channel on YouTube for years, as well as what is that? Gymnastics Bodies. What's his name is
Coach Summers.
Summers, that's it, Coach Summers. Thank you. But a lot of his principles, Coach Summers' principles, I thought were very helpful. But the actual I tell my clients, I've been telling this for a long time, and anyone that asked me about this, that your channel produces more content for free than, I'm sure there are dozens of calisthenics people that are selling programs. And I tell people, man, this Daniel Vadnal's fitness FAQs, you're going to get more free content that is very helpful. It makes a huge difference, at least it did for me, then I'm sure a lot of people that are, because I can't imagine people selling things that would be more informative than what I got from your stuff. And for people listening, no, we didn't have a conversation before this, okay? This is not a fix. I'm only kidding. But yeah, no, really, no, it's the truth. And yeah, that's why when you reached out to me for this, I was like, wow, Daniel Vadnal, holy smokes. I was very honored. Because yeah, no, I at least at the very least, it gives me a platform to thank you.
Nah, cheers. And what you said makes so much sense with calisthenics. That whole ego piece is huge. Once you can humble yourself and find bodyweight exercises that are within your capacity, then you can actually grow with it. But as you said, the average person has too much pride to be like, oh, I need to use an incline push-up to use full range of motion. Or maybe I need to be doing less reps of my pull-ups so I can actually do them with full range of motion. And it's these things with bodyweight training which keeps it really honest, because not that weights is worse or better or calisthenics is better or worse, it's just it humbles you, and that ego has to be checked or else you won't progress.
Yes. But you know, it's for people that might actually struggle from that, and they might be thinking, well, you know, that's me, but you know, that doesn't change my mind about calisthenics. On the other side of that, if you can put the ego aside, and what I did with my own calisthenics training, like for the pistol squat, and I'm still doing this right now to this day, I'm just my thing is just enter my glute and I only go to the range of motion. I use this term. I tell my clients this all the time. Right now, when you're learning, whatever you're learning, with strength training or anything else, only go to the range of motion that is easy to get into, but also easy to get out of. And that range of motion is going to be less than telling people to just see how far they can go. And oftentimes people will lower themselves in a pistol squat, but they'll realize they're stuck. It's like they climb a tree that's too high and now they got to get down. They're like, oh boy. So what I tell people is you first have to find out what is too low. So you're going to go, it's easy to kind of descend eccentrically into the first part of a pistol squat, but then they'll realize, oh, then they get the wobbles and then they lose their balance. And if they're not told to go to the zone above that, where it almost feels so easy to get into and out of that, you're not sure you're, you know, a lot of people say, am I going to get anything out of this? I said, yes, you need to polish that zone. You have to honor, you have to earn the millimeter below where you're working, and the millimeter, that all has to be earned. Nobody's going to give that to you, because you see people getting pissed off. And to me, it's like somebody being brand new at a job and working an 8-hour shift, and then they're pissed that you didn't give them a raise at the end of their shift. My thing is, bro, you might have to come back and work on the first inch of your push-up for a week, 2 weeks, whatever it takes. But I promise you, if you get that going well, 1 inch will naturally turn into 2 inches and you won't even notice it. And at the same time, it'll give your tendons, which adapt at a different rate than the muscles that are attached to them, it'll give those tendons time to adapt to the movement. Because a lot of times your muscles, you have more than enough muscular capacity to do a push-up or a pistol squat, but not if the tendon attached to it senses it could snap or not be able to get you back from where you came from. So the nervous system and the tendons need that longer time to adjust. So, and then I got a little off on tangent, but if say we just get half of a pistol squat, whatever they are barbell squatting, because all the guys love their barbell squats and their deadlifts, getting a little bit, I tell people this, getting a little better at calisthenics makes you much better at your weightlifting. Unfortunately, in my experience, getting better at weightlifting, like increasing my squat, has nothing to do with improving my pistol squat. It's weird. I can put 50, 80, 100 pounds on my squat. That doesn't mean I'm going to pistol squat better, shrimp squat better. I just recently tried a dragon squat. Yeah, those one-legged lifts, I'm just fascinated by them, because when I get a little better, I don't even care about being able to get the full range of motion, just a little better than what I did last month or last week. That translates into how my walking is better. Everything improves with small improvements in calisthenics. But I can't really say the reverse is true with conventional weightlifting, because the connectivity that's required, the systemic connectivity in the body that's required with calisthenics, it's almost hard for me to think of a calisthenics movement that doesn't involve the whole body, even though it looks like a lat movement, you know, or a push-up for the chest. I tell people the last thing I want you to feel is your upper body. I want you to feel your core. I want you to feel your legs. I want you to push with your feet as you're coming out of your push-up. Yeah, you should feel like systemically you are lifting, not lowering your chest and then lifting your chest, lowering your chest, and then the front of your shoulders here just ache because all the bad stress is going in the wrong place because your elbows are all out here. No, the calisthenics, there's a lot of truth in them. And I use them to build my humility because that's something in younger years I lacked in quantity. So to me, a lot of my training now has to do with tempering my ego and my tempering my temper and just getting a grip on myself, getting a grip on my breathing, getting to a point where I'm a little bit unsure, but just staying calm. A lot of the training now is more, you know, cognitive and neurological than just training tissue.
The principle you've just mentioned there with calisthenics is fantastic for everyone to hear. This whole idea of quality over quantity, really taking pride in your technique by using a range of motion that is within your means, and marrying this up with something I've also seen you do with calisthenics is super slow reps. If there's anything that's going to humble you, it's super slow reps. I've seen you doing a rep of a push-up, a rep of a pistol squat, but it takes 45 seconds. Can you speak about that?
My thing has always been before you go fast, you first need to go slow. And it more than what that just would seem to indicate, the slow I'm talking about is I'm not going to really test myself with heavy weights and or acceleration or speed unless I have verified that movement through my so that my tendons, ligaments, muscles, everything, if they can control every millimeter of the range of motion from all the way down, all the way up, that's an indicator for me that I can, number one, start loading it either heavier and or faster. But also, it's also by necessity that I go slow on certain lifts due to damage that I have or conditions that I have in some of my joints. So I like in the push-up type movements, you know, I've recently, I did my first clapping behind the back push-up. I've never done that before. Even when I was in my 20s, number one, I didn't see anyone do that back then. But for me to do that on my left wrist, which is pretty much bone on bone, requires a pretty specific warm-up. And that warm-up is slow. So everything I did prior to doing that one rep that I posted to my Instagram, it was all slow so that I can slowly kind of, you know, open up the joint and just make sure that it's kind of feeling. Then I kind of just did a clapping push up that felt okay. Nothing fell off, you know, nothing broke. So, but yeah, a lot of the slowness has to do with me, because I have certain issues in pretty much a lot of my joints. The way I think of going slow, what appears to be slow is me taking as much time as I need to spread the gravity of what I'm doing over as much of my system as I can to divert it away from the affected joint, but at the same time, not compensating to the left, to the right. It has to be symmetrical load. That's why I'd rather on some days just do a partial push-up in here, but the weight going through both hands is equal, even though this wrist is not really liking it. I'm loading myself equally. And then if I do that, then I can maybe, and if I kind of use my lats more, takes a little stress off the front, then I can start getting lower. Yesterday I was doing like and we'll discuss this a little later, but I was doing ring dips, which are, you know, I'm pretty, like I struggle with ring pushups. So ring dips for me are really hard. And I posted what I was able to do yesterday in the ring dip, but same thing. I have to, you know, as that easy to get in, easy to, I start, my warm up is several reps of just holding the rings at the top and trying to turn the insides of my elbows to the front. I think you call that rings turned out, or what, yeah, to externally rotate the shoulders and to hold, because that's the truthful position, right? So that's my warm up, is just being able to statically hold the lockout position at the top. Then I kind of had to rotate a little inwards and start doing my dips. But if all I have to rely on is my pecs and my triceps, I would never get as close to that repetition that I did. But what I'm doing is I'm spreading it into the lats, the rhomboids, and the traps. Because a lot of people, myself included, were taught that the dip is for the lower pecs and the triceps. And literally when I was younger, that's all I would try to use. I just try to use my pecs and my triceps, and it hurt. My shoulders just, it didn't feel right. And then later on, I think you and a few other people, I think Pavel Sotsalin talks about using the lats when you push. And so once I started learning to do that, but for me to actually kind of get everything spread out, it takes time.
And that whole going slow is great for longevity, as you said, with aches and pains in your joints and tendons. By going slow, you're highly stressing your muscles without much stress to the surrounding tissues. So simply by going slow with a sound technique, you're really going to future-proof your body to be able to do this long-term, which is one of the keys for success.
Yeah, because, you know, I see young guys and the way they're like, just boom, and everything is just fast. And, you know, curls are fast. Everything is fast because they're trying to move weight, which I understand. But I have found that, you know, I've heard this several times, that your muscle does not know what something weighs. It only knows when it's tired. It knows, you know,
tension
and the tension,
whether it's
right,
body weight or external.
Yeah. So even when I was younger, I learned quickly, no matter how, what weight room I was in or what team I was on, I was never the biggest, the strongest, nor the fastest guy. So trying to be that quickly became not important to me. What I did want to do, what I actually started going more into, was I wanted to see what was the most development I could get from the least weight. And that became kind of my thing. And that's kind of what I sell now, is not how quickly I could make my way up the dumbbell rack, or how quickly I could slap plates on my bench, on my barbell, but was like, how much development could I get? How hard, what could I do with leverage? Like earlier today, I was doing curls with 20 pound dumbbells because I was at a client's house and I only had time to do my workout there. The rest of my day after this, I'm just running around with my daughter and this and that. So I was like, okay, well, I got 20 pound dumbbells. Well, what can I do with that? Well, if I take a narrow stance and then I squat down into that narrow stance and hold that like a narrow horse stance. And what's nice about doing curls from that position is because you have to have a slightly forward angle in order as you do this so you don't fall backwards, it pushes the insides of your elbows forward, because a lot of people don't realize when they curl, especially when they're trying to go heavy, as soon as they initiate their bicep, as soon as they fire their bicep, their upper arm gets pushed backwards, which shortens the lever of their forearm in front of their body. And it gives them a leverage advantage that, sure, that they're able to get that up to the shoulders. But with all my curls, I actually just sort of like pushing it obviously in front of me. As I'm exerting into my curl upwards, I'm also focusing on pushing the inside of my elbow. As I'm bringing my belt upwards, I'm pushing my elbows forward. So I maintain a long lever through my forearm. And I've taught, or I've shown that to guys who have been lifting a long time, and they were surprised at how what they thought was their max in the curl, according to that standard, really wasn't, because they stalled out hard and they had to take a lot of weight. But the next day with a much lighter dumbbell, they felt their bicep more.
That idea of making things as hard as possible has been a game changer for me personally. And it's not even from a most difficult calisthenics exercise perspective or how much weight you're lifting. It's more the mechanics of the movement and just trying to, as we've discussed, like using that range of motion that challenges you, that tempo that challenges you, choosing positions which aren't mechanically advantageous for your body. So it's inherently harder, like that bicep curl. That's been a game changer for me because when I was younger, it was always about doing the hardest thing, doing the longest hold, doing the most reps, lifting the most weight. But then over time, as you get more advanced and you mature, you realize that you don't necessarily need the hardest X. You can just make it hard on the day with what you've got because we're not robots. We can't linearly increase what we're doing session after session after session. And although we might think that that's the case, we can get very dejected and a little bit upset at ourselves if we're not constantly progressing. Whereas now I've subscribed to that, what you've said there, Bill, over the years. And I understand maybe I've had a bit more stress in my life. Maybe my sleep hasn't been as good. I haven't been eating as well. For whatever reason, I can't do what I'm planned on the day for what I'm trying to progress towards. And just having that humility to be like, okay, that's fine. I'm still doing my workout. I'll do the best with what I can for the day. And just going back to a more subjective sense of effort, like through the technique and just doing what you can on the day. This episode is sponsored by Fitness FAQs. Become a bodyweight beast with our calisthenics workouts. Use the coupon code PODCAST10 at checkout to save 10% off when shopping at fitnessfaqs.com. Don't miss this discount. Start training smarter and enjoy the gains.
And Daniel, you know, along those lines, how tall are you?
I'm 6 foot, 183 centimeters.
Okay. And you weigh?
84-ish kilos.
84.
So that's around 190 pounds, I believe.
C1, okay, that's right. So you're 6 foot, 190. You would be considered kind of a taller, bigger guy for calisthenics, right?
Definitely.
That is the number one draw, aside from, well, no, the number one draw was the way you presented your content, just your editing and your angles and everything. It was just spot on. But there's a lot of other channels out there that are excellent. They're really great. They're wonderful content. But I could relate to you more because I didn't know how, but it was clear to me that you were a tall guy and you've got legs, which, sorry, no offense, but you look like the kind of, like, I was like, wow, that I'm not used to seeing guys that are built like you move, not just do calisthenics. I can tell by the way that you do everything that you do subscribe to this. You have worked for every degree of every movement. You've polished everything up. I can see by the way you move that you have complete control over 190 pounds. And that to me was super impressive, especially the leg lift type, you know, like L sits. Having legs like yours and holding them out, I don't think people understand, or planche, is that called a planche? Whatever, you know, any planche, okay, planche, to have your legs either, you know, face down or whatever, legs like yours, to have have the control you have. And it was also inspiring for me because I wasn't sure that guy's built like you, and because I'm about 6 foot as well, and I'm about maybe 190, we're about the same weight. And I was always kind of doubtful that guys that were built like me could move like you do. So when I found your channel, I was like, oh, this is cool. And I just watched all your videos. So
when I first started, I assumed the same thing. I was very fortunate, like most people watching and listening, to have this medium of the internet because it opens our eyes to what's possible. And in my early days of training, I only ever saw short gymnasts, short calisthenics people. And don't get me wrong, I was highly inspired. I respect what it takes to get to that level and I understand what's involved to do it. But when I saw people that were tall and heavier or fit my metrics, maybe if you're a woman listening and you look up to female calisthenics people, same thing. it opened my eyes and I was like, okay, cool. With the right dedication and consistency, I can achieve that as well. But of course, with bodyweight-based stuff, the realistic notion is that it will take longer because you're working with longer levers, more overall body mass, and doing calisthenic stuff that's exponentially harder.
Right. Yes, yes. But once again, I just want to reemphasize on the tail end of that statement, the returns that you get across the board, not just in weight, like conventional weightlifting, but whatever sport a person plays, I can't imagine any physical endeavor that is not improved by even the partial mastery of calisthenics. So
agreed.
That is why, that's why I never get discouraged now. Before, I used to get discouraged because I couldn't do the movement and I just stopped it at that. Well, if I can't do that, and it seems like that's impossible, and you know, forget it. But now I understand that just gain a teeny bit or just practice. Yes. Some days I'm worse than other days. It still is okay.
That's one of the things which hesitates people about calisthenics. They'll see someone doing a full planche, a full front lever, all these things like one-arm chin-ups, and they think, that's well beyond me. I shouldn't even start. But as you said, just working on a tuck planche, a tuck front lever, you're still getting the benefits of straight arm scapular strength. You're strengthening up the muscles in those patterns. You're getting the benefits of someone that is doing the end stage just at a level that suits you.
Yeah. For me, if I am doing something in my little gym, what I'll do sometimes is I'll do a set of squats, just conventional barbell squats. And I have a couple of rings that are hanging right off in front of me. So I'll just get up on that and I'll just hit a lockout, a ring dip, just hold the top, but I'm trying to just turn those rings outwards and externally rotate the shoulders and shake and I shake and I shake. I never do a single dip. And that I know is going to give me a big return.
Most exercises that we do in gym are forward to back in the sagittal plane. What are the benefits of training side to side or rotation?
I'm just going to speak for myself, obviously, but I used to have, even from my early 20s, lower back pain, just, you know, and I knew it had something to do with my lifting because, you know, I was doing a lot of squats, deadlifting, cleans, and you know, all of those things, if you kind of look at them, they tend to be dominant in the sagittal plane. I did all the sit-ups and the leg raises and the back extensions that are supposed to help stabilize the lower back. But my lower back, honestly, I don't know, maybe other people are different, but my lower back never really got better. In fact, I would say some of those exercises that were prescribed or recommended in some ways aggravated my back issues. And it wasn't until I started training my obliques, and my oblique training was more by accident, if I'm being honest. Shout out to Dolph Lundgren. When I saw Rocky IV, where he played the Ivan Drago, both him and Stallone, I don't know what kind of program those two were on, but in that movie, every time they were throwing punches, all I saw were these oblique muscles going just like, I'd seen obliques before, but to see how when these guys would throw those punches, the slow motion of Drago just hitting Rocky, all I saw were these oblique muscles. You could literally see how it would just close up that rib cage and generate all that torque. That's when I kind of started wanting to get more into obliques and all that. I was always wanting that look. So by the time in my early 20s, I'm doing sit-ups, leg raises, back extensions, doing none of that is working. That's when I started kind of going, I guess, off center. I also was starting to wrestle, and I had moved to Los Angeles by this time, and MMA was still kind of pretty new. I moved to LA in 94. I believe the first UFC was in 93. So I joined the Inosanto Academy, had guys like Eric Paulson there, some, you know, some pretty high level guys, but MMA was still brand new, but, you know, we'd wrestle, we'd grapple. The Gracie Academy was in Torrance. I had the privilege of working a little bit with Halson Gracie, when he moved to Honolulu, I was able to train with him for a short while before I moved to LA. But a lot of the conditions of grappling, you know, especially with jiu-jitsu guys, they're always trying to get them, their weight to one side of you to flip you. There's always this, they were just masters at putting their body weight and getting themselves in positions where they're dragging you laterally and twisting you into positions that, I mean, even in slow motion, they could take my back. And I just didn't have the, you know, I was strong up the middle. Like, you know, I could take a guy, like if they could have his legs wrapped, I could be in his guard and I could take a guy and just lift him and slam him, which you're not supposed to do. And, but if they were off to the side and starting to creep around, and I had nothing for that. And I realized it was basically like a box. So if you imagine the four walls of a box, having the front and the back facing walls, they're nice and strong. They're, say, so it's good dry, it's nice dry cardboard, but having the sides of my box slightly moist, like wet cardboard. So if you put something in a box with two strong sides and two mushy, soggy sides, that thing is just going to go splat. It's going to go spilling out the sides. So that for me, to me, the obliques, the glute medius, glute minimus muscle, the TFL muscles, you don't even have to know that. I don't care about the names of these muscles. Anything that is on the left, if you imagine your body being a knife blade or a sword for that matter. So anything that's on the blade of the body, that is a very, that to me, having that strong is more important than having pecs, lats, abs, quads. By the way, the blade of the body also includes any muscle that would adduct the shoulder or adduct the thigh. So inner thigh musculature. Yeah, a lot of the lats, you know, what is this called? The iron cross. That's like the king. That is what I also considered, obviously it's a very, very obvious, frontal plane movement. But, yeah. It's basically to strengthen the sides of the box that are largely ignored by almost all, but most people are very, very strong in the sagittal plane. So that means if you're in a hallway that's just a little wider than your shoulders, if you don't include the bulk of the training equipment, almost all people's training could occur in that hallway. So yeah, or the stress factors would all fit within the hallway. But that's why I like to hold, like, you know, barbells like a big shovel with just a few weight plates out to the side and see if I can deadlift like that and keep that bar both level parallel with the floor and not let it push my hand into my thigh. Those kind of lifts to me, I'd rather be able to do, you know, 80 pounds in that lift than 300 pounds in a regular deadlift.
For a beginner that's never seen any oblique exercises, what are your go-to movements for strengthening those side core muscles?
You know, probably for loading heavy, it would be any kind of a suitcase deadlift. Doesn't matter whether it's a barbell, kettlebell, dumbbell. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, why do you have your hand on top of your head when you're holding the weight in your other arm? This just opens and exposes. This keeps me honest because if people just have their arm at their side, and if I'm holding a heavy weight in my right hand, oftentimes if this arm is just left dangling, what people end up doing is leaning to get that weight. At some point, either usually at the top or they're having trouble, they'll start to lean. If this hand is up here, Number one, it's going to prevent you from lifting more weight than you should on that side, because a lot of people that think they can suitcase deadlift 200 pounds with their arm at their side, as soon as you put that hand up here, then they feel like they're stuck because they can't kind of do a little that a few compensatory movements. So this is number one. It's a governor switch against you loading too heavily off to one side. And as you're lifting, it just feels kind of, you'll know that you're leaning. It's number one, it's going to be very hard to lean because this lengthens the lever of everything underneath from the armpit down. The length of everything now is fully exposed. Whereas here, you know, I can even fire my lat in a way that will reinforce me on this side. I also like what's called an orbit exercise. You can do it with a dumbbell, kettlebell, or even a weight plate with handles. And it's not a halo. Because people say, oh, yeah, I like that. A halo is, you know, I was taught halos when I was certifying with the RKC in 2007. It's taking a weight and just kind of like, it's considered a shoulder mobility exercise. So an orbit, like, you know, when you look at planets orbiting the sun or the moon orbiting the earth, it doesn't orbit the earth up here. It orbits around more of the circumference of the planet. So yes. That's why I tell people when they're doing an orbit the way I would like them to, all parts of whatever weight you're using must stay below the top of your head. Because as soon as I challenge them to try to keep, so that thing cannot poke above their head. That forces them now to have to maneuver their rib cage. If the rib cage is moving, well, the obliques and the abs are attached to that rib cage. So that's what we're getting though. We want the rib cage like a joystick on a video game. I want a circumductive challenge to the rib cage the way, like if there were muscles on the joystick of a video game, those muscles would be getting a similar challenge.
That's a great exercise cue because it gives people an external focus. They don't have to think, oh, am I activating my obliques by bending this way? No, by doing the orbit core exercise, you're getting that full range of motion of the spine articulating around. And of course, as you said, fully activating those obliques and other core muscles.
Right.
What about neck training for people that don't have equipment?
I'm actually much more of an advocate for training the front of the neck, the sternocleidomastoids and the flexors of the neck, than I am for training the back of the neck. Number one, training the back of the neck is a lot easier. You know, there's just tons of ways. You can just take towels and tie weights to them and just hang them. You can bridge on the floor. You can bridge on a ball, like an exercise ball. You can even bridge on your bed, just putting your head on the corner, on the edge of the bed and just making a table out of your tummy. That is, the back of the neck is for most people, even if they don't, it's just disproportionately strong. This is not medical advice. This is what's worked for me in the past. I've had some neck issues. A lot of people have headaches and also TMJ, but by simply just practicing a neck curl, right? Just lie on a firm surface, preferably like a bench, an exercise bench, a massage table, but even a firm bed works well. I kind of make an underbite with my teeth. I pretend that I'm biting on like, just like a pad of paper. I pretend like I'm biting on a pad of paper with a slight underbite, and I will just hang my head off the edge of a bed and I'll just curl. And I try to curl through the longest range of motion that I can. So rather than just letting my head drop backwards like a Pez dispenser, I'm trying to, like if you were to put a ball behind my neck, I'm trying to lengthen the back of my neck over that ball. So from that long lever, I am now bringing back. It should feel like the head is being pulled through a very long range of motion or a long curl. And there is a device out there because the conventional way of doing this is taking like a small or whatever weight plate Ioana with a towel, putting it on your forehead and just kind of holding the plate and doing curls with that. Most people don't need any weight for a long time. People trying neck curls, if they're cleared to do so by their healthcare professionals, just trying to do a few reps with just the weight of their head. And for a long, long time, that's all the weight most people need. There was a device that I have a device called the Strong Neck, not to be confused with the Iron Neck that we were just discussing, but the Strong Neck is just a device that it has a little post here. It's a padded plastic device that you go put on your forehead with a center post, and you can just put like a weight plate on there and hold that and just do some neck curls. But for me, I posted a video using it, and I like to post what I honestly can lift more than what I think is going to impress people. The weight plate I was using on that device was a 5-pound plate, and that's all I needed. So I've been the front of the neck. If you balance the strength of the front of the neck with the back of the neck, then a lot of people, they don't care about taking punches or getting choked or whatever. But a lot of people have headaches, and I have found that the people that I have shown this to, training the front of the neck with just simple curls, assuming that doesn't aggravate any pre-existing or conditions you're not aware of, assuming that just goes well, I tell people to do small amounts of that, because in the beginning, it's very likely with just a few reps that they could start feeling a little nauseous. So people,
especially
just
if you're doing positional-based stuff relative to gravity off the edge of a bed, it's no surprise that vestibular system can feel a bit funny. Right.
And if you have two obliquely attaching strong muscles that are out of balance, they're basically trying to twist your head in the worst way. Not just like this, but also kind of,
I could see that theory of the one-sided headaches might be present if you have some asymmetry. So from your personal experience, you found that a weaker neck can be correlated with headaches, which if you want to have a conservative approach for fixing that, exercising the deep neck flexors and the superficial ones with neck curls can help. What's the minimum effective dose you found for that, for training the neck?
And I tell people that when they first start doing neck curls, maybe do 2 or 3 very easy sets and then stop. Just stop, because people are sometimes surprised at how when they just practice the process of trying to do neck curls, they don't necessarily feel really tired that day, but the next day they're like, wow, my neck is kind of, they almost wonder if they injured themselves or something. Not injured themselves, but if they overdid it. The neck muscles are very deceptive. They strengthen up very quickly. That's the good news. But when you first start training them, especially the flexors, these guys, they need very little. I tell people, don't train your neck, stretch your neck. Just think of trying to find a position, set your jaw in a way, and the jaw position is very important. They should make like they are biting down, but biting down on something where their teeth are not touching. Number one, nobody should really bite down as hard as they can on their own teeth. That's just not a good thing to do. But also that underbite thing is important. So this looks so funny, but this position with the lower jaw jutting out, as soon as you bring your head back, you're going to feel right under here all these attachments. And another thing I tell people about training the neck in general, especially the front of the neck, is if people are worried about, you know, as they get older, these, what do they call these things, wattles or whatever, these, you know, how the
skin, gooseneck action.
Gooseneck, right. And they start to just kind of like, so when they were young, they had this nice defined jaw, and now they just have this thing of skin that makes their chin turn into their chest right here, this this right here is, and that's, you know, that's a bummer. So, but what, that's just like any other skin that kind of gets, that skin is attached to muscles, and there's a ton of muscles under here. I don't even know the names of them, and I don't care. But when you create a slight underbite and then you extend your head back and you bring it forward, you're literally going to feel muscles that attach here working. And if those muscles stay strong, the collagen that keeps the skin stuck to them is also going to stay strong. And it, and so say someone doesn't care about neck strength, but they care about how they look as they get older. That's another big reason why I'm huge on the jaw and the bite, the masseter muscles. At the very least, it'll keep you from looking old and weak, and it'll prevent the mandible here. Because what makes people's faces look old, and why do they feel like they need to get a lift? Because their cheekbones, these zygomatic bones, as well as the mandibles here, as we get old, already in modern society, young people, all people in modern society, the food we eat is very soft. Even steaks, you know, when I was growing up, steaks were a lot tougher. We didn't have the kind of selective breeding or genetics or whatever they're doing. Everything was tougher when I was younger. And I can imagine generations before that, it was even worse. So, but now everything is made for convenience and to be easy, and filet and Wagyu beef and everything melts in your mouth. So the challenge to the masseter muscles, there's almost none of it. And the density of bone is dependent on the strength of the muscles that attach to those bones. So, and then as we get older, naturally our hormones, and we start eating softer foods because our teeth start getting all messed up. So as people get older, their masseters start to atrophy. And so their anchor bones, the cheekbones, and then the jaw bones, they start to shrink. That's why if you look at old people, one of the things that makes them look old is this jaw, this here gets real small. And then the teeth start collapsing in on that. And these cheekbones here, all these people that are shooting all this whatever stuff in their faces, well, they're basically, if they would exercise those muscles, it's sort of like not doing any work with your arms. Your biceps start to shrink, so you start shooting or whatever fillers into your arm to make up for that lost volume. No, just work it.
That was a good summary about neck training having a potential impact on pain and headaches in addition to aesthetics. But we also have to think just the basics of injury and performance at large. We always know that what happens at one joint affects the joints surrounding it. So if we're having shoulder problems or further up into the neck being the local one, we know that by training the neck, it can have an influence on things such as discomfort around the traps or weakness. It can be interrelated in that respect.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I actually believe that a lot of shoulder issues, and then everything downstream from the shoulder, tennis elbow, carpal tunnel, whatever, I believe a lot of that comes from the jaw, even precedes the neck. I have, you know, have you seen those videos where I'm lifting a barbell with a rag in my teeth?
I've seen it. It is quite crazy, Bill. Very crazy.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of people look at that like, I totally understand if people think, oh, you're just doing that for the gram, or you're trying to get likes, or what? No, I've been doing that forever.
How often would you recommend people doing this jaw/neck training to get the benefits that you've outlined?
Well, you know, the jaw to me, it seems like a muscle. It's something that let's go to earlier times, that we would have to use every day. I believe it has a high work capacity and a high capacity to recover. I believe the masseter muscle is, per its size, the most powerful or the strongest muscle in the human body and probably most animals. So, I mean, it would be extreme for someone to train their jaw every day. But I believe if they were to just do small amounts, they could. But, you know, like most things, 3 days a week.
And given the fact that we're doing a isometric contraction, that's arguably not a very fatiguing stimulus or amount of tension to create compared to, say, a eccentric movement or even full range combining eccentrics?
Yeah, that's why I like to use the barbell lifts, because it involves a prolonged static utilization of the jaw and the neck. The neck is simply the top of the spinal column. That's why I'm as perplexed as to people's surprise at what I do with my neck training as they are watching me do it. Because to me, I don't know why the neck slash the top of the spine is such a taboo or unknown topic.
I guess it's one of those things because we never see it conventionally exercised, and most people's understanding of the neck is danger. We hear about someone doing cliff diving and they sever their spinal cord in the cervical area, being the neck, and we conflate that with danger, which there is inherent danger with neck training because you are moving and loading the tissues around that area. But it comes back to exercise in general is about the load being what you can tolerate. People see you doing this and they don't understand that you've started with just your body weight and then you added half a pound, a pound, all the way up to these big loads, and you have expertise in doing so. You've adapted your tissues to you that's safe. People just need to understand that, yes, there is risk because of what we said with the spinal cord at the neck being a bit precarious for this, but if you do it sensibly and progress it within your means, listen to your body, you mitigate your risks.
Exactly. Yeah. I tell people, you know, people say, oh, you're going to die. I say, no, I've been doing this for a long, long time. And it has saved me from some pretty dire circumstances, both just accidents on the street, like in my car, as well as on the jiu-jitsu mat.
What exercises or movements do you feel are missing from mainstream workouts?
Holding a static position, like in the legs, while moving a weight or some kind of resistance load in the upper body. I believe a lot of conventional training is based on the performance of eccentric and concentric repetitions. So there's always a movement. We're always in motion, like in a squat or a deadlift. I'm also a big fan of very slowly entering a certain range of motion and then being able to stay there, and then maybe entering a lower range of motion and being able to stay there.
What benefits have you found from challenging that deepest range isometrically?
You know, number one, earlier we were talking about training the mind. I find the more it's kind of an unpleasant. A lot of people think, you know, and it is, you know, this, it starts to burn. It's uncomfortable holding these things, you know, holding, like going halfway into the push-up and holding that.
Yeah, it's unrelenting attention.
It's unrelenting. But you know what I also hear from people? Oh, they'll drop through it, or they'll just come back up. They'll bail in some way on a static exercise. They'll bail, and they will maybe misinterpret their, to me, it's a form of panic, but they'll say, I got bored. That's boring. Nobody actually wants to acknowledge that what they're calling boring is actually, it kind of kicked my ass and I couldn't take it. So I like static training, number one, for the mind, because you can take all your pre-workout and put on your heavy metal, your speed music, and blast through hard reps and but to actually try to hold, like say you squat 300 pounds and I put 135 on a bar, just a big plate on each side, and I ask you to squat not ass to the grass. I'm not a big fan of holding ass to the grass because you're just resting on a lot of tendons at the bottom. But go ass to the grass, then come up about 10, 15% from there. So you're actually, your leg muscles are supporting you and the bar. That for me also develops besides developing the mind's more the emotional capacity of the mind, it's, to me, it strengthens the link, the neuromuscular link between the mind and these muscles that we're moving, is being able to hold and lock these positions in. Also, for what I like in a lot of, especially in grappling or even in Muay Thai and things like that, a lot of your ability to get to do things has to do with your ability to hold and lock a position. A lot of jiu-jitsu is being able to just stabilize something for a, what seems like an ungodly amount of time. But the real life applications.
If people for regular exercise want to optimize their breathing for best performance.
Nose breathing. And that's nose breathing just basically all day long, breathing through your nose. The sinus tissues, there are nerves in the sinus cavity that more or less directly innervate or activate the diaphragm. And so when we pull air through or into the sinuses, it actually expands these tissues. Air is like the weights that the muscles in the sinus cavity use to stay dilated and open. The importance of nasal breathing is I like to use it to train the diaphragm. You can also recruit your diaphragm by breathing through your mouth as well, but it just seems that due to these are much narrower passages. So I can get, because they're narrower, if I'm taking the same volume of air through my nose, through a narrow passage, I get this long of an inhalation. Now my trachea is a much larger passage. So to take the same volume or relative volume of air through my mouth, that's all I get. And if I do that, I only get air drops into the upper part of the lungs. But if I'm able to, especially if my belly is, I'm pulling with my diaphragm, and my diaphragm, as it intrudes into my abdominal cavity, displaces my belly forward. That's why this thing about, you know, when you breathe, your belly should come out. That's just evidence that the diaphragm is lowering strongly enough into the abdominal cavity to displace some of the viscera or your guts, to push them outwards in front of you. So when you're belly breathing through the nose, presumably you're using your diaphragm in a way, and the resistance of just the guts against the diaphragm is a way of the diaphragm lifting weights. So that's the first thing anyone should have, whether they're strength training or not.
That was well explained, Bill, really about the mechanics and the benefits. Something so simple people can apply is breathing through their nose instead of their mouth, which can take some time if you've been a consistent mouth breather. But if you just are more aware of it in your day-to-day life, you can start using some tactile strategies, as you said, temporarily, such as taping the mouth. And also something can be profoundly beneficial for people that do struggle with nasal breathing. Of course, we want to try and do that off our own accord, using our nose to do so, and no external aids or anything like that. But when going to sleep, the nasal strips that open up the bridge of the nose as you're going to sleep can significantly improve people's quality of sleep, has been known to reduce things like sleep apnea in very mild cases, snoring, etc. So my advice to people would be, do your best to integrate nasal breathing, diaphragmatic breathing into life and exercise, but also that inexpensive hack of nasal strips you can buy anywhere of an evening when you go to sleep kind of gives you the best of all worlds.
It truly does, yeah.
Bill Maeda, appreciate your time. You're clearly someone who's always learning, trying to improve, and sharing your journey and inspiring others. Where can people follow your work if they want to keep up to date?
You know, my social media, at Bill Maeda on TikTok and on Instagram.
Perfect. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Daniel. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your podcast, and thank you for what you do, because a lot of what you've done, I've been able to leverage that and, you know, share it with my clients and whoever else would watch or listen to me. So thank you. I really appreciate what you've done.
If you enjoyed that, click here for another value-packed Fitness FAQs video. Peace.